Okay, the mentioned a few ideas about Lech Lecha, since it really probably has a lot of relevance to all of us here. The Reb Chaim Volozhiner says that all of the tests of Avraham Avinu were partly not only to benefit him personally, but were to create a reservoir of strength for all generations to draw upon. He says if Avraham Avinu would not have been ready to sacrifice his son, no Jew in history would have ever been able to die al Kiddush Hashem or to sacrifice his family al Kiddush Hashem, as has been done throughout history. He says the same thing goes for Lech Lecha. If Avraham Avinu did not have the strength to leave his familiar surroundings, leave his family, and go to Eretz Yisrael, no Jew in history would have been able to do that. So the fact that I guess all of us had the ability to leave other countries and come here, we drew on the reservoir of Avraham Avinu. Now, just an aside, before I really get what I want to say, on the surface that doesn't seem to make sense, because we know that Goyim also sacrifice themselves for their gods, and they don't have an Avraham Avinu to draw upon. So why did the Jewish people need an Avraham Avinu to be able to sacrifice themselves for Kiddush Hashem if Goyim can do it without an Avraham Avinu? Right? So I think the answer could possibly be the following. Bring you an example from another area. When I was a rabbi in Miami, so my shul in Miami was relatively quiet during davening compared to other shuls in Chutz Laretz. Right? It's a hallmark of shuls, especially in America, to be extremely noisy. People talk, they during davening, during laning. I remember once I had to speak in three shuls in the morning. We were raising funds and recruiting people for the moshav, and I was in Kew Garden Hills. I shouldn't have said that. In any case, I had to speak in three different shuls there. I spoke in one shul after Shacharis before laning. I was supposed to come to the second shul for laning, speak after laning, and go to the next shul for Musaf and speak after Musaf. All in the same morning. So I finished speaking in the first shul, and I came to the second shul, and there was pandemonium there. And as mamash, not people weren't talking, but they were like yelling. And I thought that maybe some terrible thing had happened there, and so I pushed my way up to the front of the shul and found out they were laning. But nobody really cared. Everybody was talking, and since everybody was talking, they were talking so loud that in order to be able to be heard over everybody else, they had to yell. So my shul in Miami was relatively quiet, but still wasn't perfect. So once at a bar mitzvah where many people came who were not usual attendees of an Orthodox shul, and a man came over to me after davening, and he said, "Rabbi, I usually go to a conservative temple. And in my temple, right, everybody's quiet, you can hear a pin drop, right, there's respect and decorum. You people are supposed to be more religious, and you don't have any respect for your shul. People are talking, walking around." So what my balabatim would have told that person is, well, you feel strange in your temple, so you come and you sit quietly or whatever. We feel Hamish in our shul, so we act Hamish. But that's not a good answer. Because I usually told my balabatim, if you're using that answer, there's a very big difference between Hamish and Behamish. That doesn't answer the question. So, what is the answer? I don't remember if I told him this or not, but I'll tell you what I think the answer is. The Yetzer Hara, okay, would love people to desecrate a holy place. And therefore, the Yetzer Hara fights his hardest to make people speak in a bona fide shul, because that's what he wants. On the other hand, the same Yetzer Hara would love for people to treat a place that has no holiness, where it is a travesty of Jewish law, to treat it as if it's holy. That's what the Yetzer Hara wants. So it's very easy to remain quiet in a temple that is not halachic, and it's very hard to keep quiet in a place that is halachic. That's exactly what the Yetzer Hara is. And that's why for a goy to give his life for Buddha, life for Krishna, for all the other Avodah Zarahs, the Yetzer Hara loves that. He doesn't fight against it. You don't need an Avraham Avinu to be able to do that. The Satan helps along. There's no resistance. Masha'en came for a Jew to give his life for the Rabbanu Shalol, and the Satan fights that tooth and nail. Without the power of an Avraham Avinu, we couldn't have done it. That, I think, is the answer. In any case, no Jew in history would have had the power to leave what's it called, Golis, and come to Eretz Yisrael. Had Avraham Avinu not had that, had not done it first. Okay. But Avraham Avinu didn't stam come to Eretz Yisrael when God told him to come. According to the Seder Olam, Avraham Avinu was in Eretz Yisrael 5 years earlier before God told him to come here. He had gone on his own. How do we know that? Because the Bris Bein HaBesorim, right, the covenant that God made with Avraham, and there told him that his children would be strangers and enslaved afflicted, right, tortured for 400 years. The Chora, where's these 400 years? We were only 210 years in Egypt. Where's the 400 years? So the Seder Olam says the 400 years were from the birth of Yitzchak. When Yitzchak Avinu was born, if you figure out the years, from the time that Yitzchak was born till we left Mitzrayim was 400 years. Yet there's another problem. The Torah says that we left after 430 years. Where's that extra 30 years? So the Seder Olam says the 30 extra years is back to Bris Ben Abisorim, the covenant where God foretold to Avraham Avinu this would happen was 30 years earlier. Now Avraham Avinu was 100 when he had Yitzchak. That means that 30 years earlier he was 70. That means that the covenant which was made in Eretz Yisrael was when Avraham was 70. When was Lech Lecha? When he was 75. So that means that Avraham Avinu was in Eretz Yisrael 5 years before Lech Lecha, went back to Haran, and then God told him to come back. So the obvious question is, why would the Rabbanu Shalom not let him stay in Eretz Yisrael, knowing that in 5 years he's going to tell him to come back?
First your reign.
So why? Why would the Rabbanu Shalom not tell him, look, 5 years from now I'm going to tell you to come here, you might as well stay here? Why do you let him go back and then come back? So the Shaloh HaKadosh says the following reason. He said because, just as we said, that Jews have to get that reservoir of strength from Avraham Avinu, Jews also needed, God knew that for many, many years during Golus, we're going to be in Chutz Laretz. And he wanted the Jewish people to be able to have the strength to have gaguim, to long, right, to come back to Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu was here. He was told that eventually he's going to get this land. He had tremendous, tremendous feeling for the land. Then he went back to Chutz Laretz. He had tremendous gaguim, tremendous longing. When will I be able to go back? Those 5 years of longing created the reservoir that Jews should be able to long for Eretz Yisrael, even if they can't be here. Okay. What's the purpose of that? Seems to be very frustrating. Right? What's the purpose of being in Golus and longing for Eretz Yisrael? Okay. So I think there's three purposes to that. The first one is that if you get used to Golus, Okay? And you don't have this feeling, this longing, that you want to be really where you should be in Eretz Yisrael. Like, unfortunately, many Jews in Chutz Loretz have. They don't feel they're missing anything. Right? They feel that they have whatever they have. And it's fine. You have no reason to want to come to Eretz Yisrael. So even though there are legitimate reasons not to come to live in Eretz Yisrael, legitimate reasons that would allow a person to stay in Chutz Loretz, Parnassa reasons, there are other reasons also. But if a person has no desire, then even if all the circumstances are positive, you'll never come. You don't have any reason to. But if a person has this feeling that he's missing something by living outside of Eretz Yisrael, and coming to Eretz Yisrael, right, adds something to his life as a Jew, and even though he won't be able to come here, for whatever reason, circumstances beyond his control, but if those circumstances would go away, then he come. So there is a benefit to desire to want to come back, in order that when the circumstances will present themselves, you'll be able to come back. Second reason, similar to that, a little bit different, and that is when Jews feel comfortable in Eretz, in Chutz Loretz, in Golus, and they have no desire to come back to Eretz Yisrael, that in itself is a condemning factor. The Yavet says that he can attribute all the tzoras that happened in Golus to the fact that we don't mourn for the Beis HaMikdash, we don't feel we're missing anything. Jews have, you know, built permanent places in Chutz Loretz, feel comfortable there, feel settled there, don't feel that they are misplaced and not in their own, where they really should be. And because of that feeling, right, that's why all the tzoras happen in Golus. And I think the correlation is, then, if you have all these tzoras in Golus, you can't feel that comfortable there. You can't feel so smug that this is my place, because they're reminding you constantly it's not your place. And the third reason, I think, is the following. It says that if a person wants to do a mitzvah, but he can't, for reasons beyond his control, then the desire, machshava tova, kodesh baruch matzar for lemaisa. If you have a good intention, but you can't fulfill that intention because of circumstances beyond your control, then God considers if it, you did that mitzvah. You get credit for the mitzvah. Therefore, if somebody lives in Chutz Loretz because of circumstances beyond his control, right, whatever the reasons are, and there are legitimately reasons, like we said, for a person not to come to Eretz Yisrael. Somebody who's born in Chutz Loretz to remain there. There's even reason, legitimate reasons to leave Eretz Yisrael, at least temporarily, to go to Chutz Loretz. But if a person is there, and because of circumstances beyond his control, he can't come here, but he wants to come here, and if those circumstances weren't there, he'd love to be here, then it's considered like he's here. So it's a tremendous chus for Klal Yisrael. Even the ones living in Chutz Loretz have the status as if they're living in Eretz Yisrael, at least mentally, and that in itself is a chus for Klal Yisrael. So for those three reasons, the Rebbeinu Shlom wanted Avraham Avinu to go back 5 years to Chutz Loretz, and to long to have gaguin, to be able to come back, and that is the I think the idea. My drasha this Shabbos, I'm going to say another idea, but we'll leave that for now. Okay. Next, let me skip a little bit to try to say a few shorter things instead of one long thing, so we can. It says that when the war between the four kings and the five kings took place, and the four kings vanquished the five kings, one of the five kings was the king of Sodom, and they overran Sodom, and they took all of the people of Sodom captive, including Lot. And says that when the king of Sodom and the king of Amorah ran away from the battlefield, they ran through a Shdei Chomer, right? Be'eros Chomer. And the king of Sodom fell into one of these lime pits. And usually, you fall into a lime pit, you're burnt, right? Completely dissolved. Okay, you fall into lime, that's, what's it called? A strong base, right? So it's a base. So it burns you up like an acid. So miraculously, he was saved. He was saved. He miraculously survived that. Now, why in the world, says Rashi, would God do a miracle to save the king of Sodom? He wasn't exactly, you know, the biggest tzaddik in the world. So why save him? Says Rashi, because there were people who didn't believe that Avraham Avinu was saved from the fiery furnace. Similar thing. And when they saw the king of Sodom saved from the pit of lime, they believed in Avraham retroactively. They said if it could happen to him, it could happen to him too. That's a simple idea. The Ramban asks on this Rashi, I don't understand what he's talking about. First of all, what in the world is there a connection between the fact that the king of Sodom was saved and that Avraham Avinu was saved from the Kipshim? Maybe this happened and that didn't happen. People didn't believe it till now. And he says, if you'll tell me that what happened was Avraham Avinu came onto the battlefield. And when he came close to the pit that the king of Sodom had fallen into, miraculously he emerged from the pit in the schus of Avraham, and then people believed if Avraham could save this guy, right, in his merit, surely he could save himself. He says, Ikur Chosim and Asefer. It doesn't say that. Right? And the main part is that the king of Sodom was saved because of Avraham Avinu. That part is missing from the story. I have another question. The language doesn't make sense. It says they believed in Avraham Limafreya retroactively. How do you believe in something retroactively? From now on, they believed in it. They didn't believe in it retroactively. What does that mean? Limafreya. So I want to say the following. How is it possible that the people of that time didn't believe that Avraham Avinu was saved from the fiery furnace? Right? If, you know, it would have been Avraham Avinu came home one day, said, you know, I wanted to see what happens if I go into a fiery furnace. And he put himself in his oven, right, came out okay, and went around telling the people in his neighborhood what happened. So then he could say he didn't believe it. But that wasn't the case. What happened was, this little kid was going around saying there was a God who was invisible, who created the whole world, and that Nimrod was not God. Okay, which bothered Nimrod tremendously. So he decided he is going to get rid of this little kid, and he is going to make a public demonstration that what the kid is saying is not true. How is he going to do that? He's going to kill this kid in a fantastic way, burn him up in a fiery furnace, and therefore put to rest all of this narishkeit that he's saying that there's a God who's not Nimrod. So Nimrod did not do this privately. He did it publicly. Okay? He called all the radio, television, right, internet stations, right, to witness this. He didn't have an inkling that Avraham Avinu was going to come out of this alive. Right? And he announced, we are going to put to rest all of this narishkeit about there being an invisible God who created the world, right now. Threw Avraham into the Kipshin Reish, and he came out. That means it was witnessed by a multitude of people. People saw it. It was witnessed by a multitude. How in the world could people not believe it happened? It was a historical fact. Now the answer is very simple. There are a lot of historical facts that people don't believe in because they don't want to believe in them. There are Holocaust deniers. Now how in the world can you deny the Holocaust? Something that happened, right, in front of world history. There were 6 million Jews in Europe before World War II. At the end, 6 million Jews were missing. I mean, there were more than 6 million. But there was... where'd they go? They're hiding under the bed. Where in the world are these people? Right? It's totally illogical to be a Holocaust denier. So why are there Holocaust deniers? Because they don't want to believe in the Holocaust, because that brings mercy to the Jewish people, and they hate the Jewish people. So basically, they deny it. Right? There are a lot of things in this world that there are people deny that they landed on the moon. They said it was done in Nevada. There's people who deny a lot of things. You believe what you want to believe. And therefore, sometimes people can blind their eyes from seeing the truth. Right, without any rationale. It's totally irrational. But I don't want to believe it. Finished. People who smoke, right, can put all the evidence in front of them, right, that it is life-threatening. And they blind their eyes to the fact because they enjoy smoking. So it means nothing to them. They deny it. Is there any rational reason to deny it? No. But they close their eyes and blind their eyes, and it just doesn't exist. People can see what they want to see and not see what they don't want to see. Somebody once told me, a very rational Ben Torah. I asked him, how can you smoke? There's so much evidence that it's dangerous to your health. Why do you want to take such a risk? He said, well, all the information, all of the data about how smoking is harmful was done on Goyim who smoke 7 days a week. I don't smoke on Shabbos, so it has no relevance to me. The tests mean nothing to somebody who only smokes 6 days a week. That makes any sense to you? This person is a logical, rational person, but he believed that because that's what he wanted to do. So these people did not believe in Avram, not because rationally they had reason not to believe, because they just blotted out of their mind. Don't confuse me with the facts. I don't want to. If I believe that Avram was safe in the Kibshon Reish, I'm going to have to believe that there's a God. I don't want to believe there's a God. So end of the thing. I'm not going to leave. As long as they had no other explanation of how Avraham Avinu survived the Kibshon Reish except God, then they blotted out of their mind. But once the king of Sodom was saved in a similar way, and they said, no reason in the world why God would want to save the king of Sodom. So it must be there's another explanation how people could be saved like that. Supernatural things happen. Things that are beyond nature, but they happen. It's a quirk. Now they could believe in Avraham Lemafreya. Now, retroactively, it's okay to believe that Avram was saved, because now I have another explanation. And if you don't think that happens, I'll give you an example. Why would God do that? Good question. The reason the Rebbe Shem did that is to show them how fickle they were. Yesterday you didn't believe it. Today you do. What changed? Now that you have another explanation, so then obviously you're very false people. That's what the Rebbe Shem wanted to show them. Hopefully maybe made an impression on some of them. I'll tell you what I think is similar to that. Up until around the 1950s, anyone who believed in a soul, right, that a human being was not just 98 cents at that time of chemicals, right, but there was something beyond the physical, there was a spiritual side of man, was laughed upon. It was unscientific, it was fairy tales, it was for people of weak minds to believe in a soul. Right? Not totally unscientific. Then, in the 1950s, early 60s, there was a Swedish scientist, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who dealt with patients who were dying of incurable diseases, like cancer patients or whatever, people who were
terminally ill,
thank you, exactly, terminally ill. And many of these people, right, had clinical deaths and came back. And she researched all these clinical deaths and she found that they were very similar what the people said that they experienced. And people who clinically died, right, could feel like they were separating from their body, floating in the air, looking down on their body, right, from the ceiling, and feeling this tremendous feeling of peace and serenity. And then all of a sudden they felt themselves going through a tunnel, seeing this big light, hearing tremendous music, feeling they're standing before a being that was all-knowing, and then feeling that they're being drawn back. Now, many of these people could describe the room where they were being operated on or whatever from the ceiling. They never were there. They were in basically clinically dead during that time. There was very little way of explaining how it works. And she, therefore, came to the conclusion that there's obviously some spiritual side to a person, more than just his physical side, that exists after death. Somebody once said this over in Matityahu, and a woman there, I won't tell you who it is, she made me promise I wouldn't say. She came over and she said, until now, I have kept this to myself, because I thought people would think I'm crazy. If you're telling me now that this is, a study, and she wrote a book, right? And she wrote a book, what's it called, on death and dying and life after death, with a reverend, what's it called, Mooney. In any case, so she said, when I was about 12 years old, my family was at the beach, and I was swimming, and I began to drown. And they pulled me from the water to resuscitate me, and I remember feeling like I was leaving my body, and watching from above, floating above, and watching what they were doing, and I felt so good and serene that I was screaming to them, "Stop! Don't bring me back. I'm happy where I am." And then she felt herself being drawn back into her body when they were able to resuscitate her. She said, "I never told anybody this because I thought they'd think I was out of my mind. But now I see that that's something that other people have experienced, exactly the same thing." In any case, so once this study became well known, so now it was accepted in the scientific community that there is a spiritual side of a human being. Okay, why? Somebody saw it. Somebody, what's it called? They could have explained it away a million different ways, which they did. They said, now we have another way of, till 1950, right, the only explanation for a soul was religion, God. Science did not want to accept God or religion, and therefore they denied the fact that it could be a soul. But now they had another explanation. It's just, you know, an extra, extra, what's it called, what do they call it? A astral projection of a person, right? It's a quasi-physical part of the person that can be separated from the person. It's not a soul, has nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with God. It's just that this exists, that a person's spiritual side or whatever can separate from his physical side. Once they had an explanation that it had nothing to do with religion and nothing to do with God, I can accept the soul too. Even though nobody ever weighed one, put one in a test tube, or saw one. But now it became scientific. So what yesterday I couldn't believe in because I didn't want to believe in it because it intimated religion, today I can believe in it. That's what happened then. Yesterday I couldn't believe that Avraham Avinu was safe in the Kivshon HaEsh because if it's true, then it proves as a God. Then obviously a God was saving his favorite son. But if today I have another explanation, because why in the world would a God want to save Melech Sodom? So now I can say that it's just a quirk of nature. There are things, you know, extrasensory perception, things that happen, you know, beyond nature, but it has nothing to do with God, nothing to do with religion. Now I can believe in it. So that's what it means. And why would the Rabban Shem do such a thing? To show them how fickle they were. Yesterday you didn't believe it. What changed? Only that you have another explanation today. So maybe you're not intellectually honest. That's the idea. Okay, let's go to another thing. It says that the Rabban Shem told Avraham Avinu he's going to have children. And it says, Vayamin Bashem, Vayachshaveh lo tzedakah. He believed God, and God's way Rashi learns, and God considered it a tzedakah, tremendous merit to Avraham Avinu that he believed him. Says the Ramban, that doesn't make any sense. Well, what did God think? He's going to tell Avraham Avinu, look, I'm God, I'm telling you that I'm going to give you children. What did he expect Avraham Avinu to say? Go on, you're pulling my leg, it can't be, right? And God was really shocked. Wow, he believes me. So I really consider that a tremendous merit. I didn't think he believed me at all, right? He believes me. What does that mean? Of course, the Rabban Shem tells you something, you believe him. And the Rabban Shem expected Avraham Avinu to believe him. What's this big tzedakah that Avraham believed? What does it mean? Says the Ramban, therefore the meaning of the sentence is just the opposite. Vayamin Bashem. Avraham Avinu believed that God was going to give him children. Vayachshaveh lo tzedakah. Avraham considered it a tzedakah, a favor, not that he deserved it. He considered the fact that God promised him children a favor and not deserved. That, says the Ramban, that makes sense. But the other way, what does it mean? So I'll tell you what I think it means. There's an argument between the Rambam and the Bahag, the Baal Halachas Gedolos, whether there's a mitzvah to believe in God. You don't have to believe in God. Okay? The question is it a mitzvah? Is it a command? Okay, or not? The Bahag says it can't be a command, because a command assumes there's a commander giving that command. So if you believe in God, then God can come to you and say, keep Shabbos, eat kosher. Right? Why? Because I believe that there's a God who's telling me that. So I believe in the commander, now I can have a command. But if I don't believe in God, somebody comes to me and says, God said, believe in him. Who said? I don't believe in him to begin with. Who said? There can't be a command if there isn't an assumed commander. So if you don't believe in God, nobody can come and tell you to believe in him, because I don't believe in him to begin with. Who's commanding me? So he says, it's not that you don't have to believe in God, you do, but it's not a command. It's a axiom. In other words, if you accept that foundation, then we can start with commands. If you don't accept that foundation, there's nowhere to start. But it's not a command to believe in God, it is a foundation to believe in God. If you accept that foundation, fine. In fact, Rashi seems to say that in the beginning of the Aseres Hadibros, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Accept my malchus, accept my ability to tell you what to do, and now we'll have the commands. If you don't accept that, there's nowhere to start. The Rambam, on the other hand, counts belief in God as a mitzvah. It's one of the tzarik mitzvahs. So the question is, who is it to? To somebody who believes already, you don't need a mitzvah. To somebody who doesn't believe in God, there can't be a mitzvah. So who's this mitzvah to? So there are other explanations, but based on what we said here now, the idea is the following. Belief does not mean just, I believe. Right? There's a line. Either you're on this side of the line, you're believers, or on this side of the line, you're not believers. Like, you know, the missionaries, the evangelists get, you know, people into the deepest Africa into tents, and they give them a whole spiel about believing in Yashka or whatever, and by the end of the night, everybody screams, we believe, we believe, so they go from non-believers to believers, and that's it, they cross the line, and now they're believers. That's just the beginning. Belief entails a tremendous amount of things. For instance, there's a difference between believing something and really, really feeling it, that it's real. Right? And that doesn't mean a person doesn't believe. He believes, but it's not the same. The example they give and tells to the difference between believing something intellectually and really feeling it where it's real to you is the following. In America, at least when I was still there, they had a certain green paint that they must have had millions of gallons stored up, because every park bench in America was painted with that color green. Okay? And sometimes you go into the park and there'll be a sign on the bench, wet paint, you see the paint glistening. Okay? What is the natural reflex reaction of most people when they see that sign? Go over to the bench. Exactly. And then look at their finger and see the green paint. Why? Don't you believe signs? You see it's glistening. But there's a very big difference between intellectually knowing that that bench is wet paint and feeling it. Now it's real to me. Now it's real. Different, completely different world. What you experience is much different than what you just know. To the point where sometimes what you see, even if it contradicts what you intellectually know, what you see is stronger. The Sefer HaIkarim says that even Moshe Rabbeinu, what made an impression on him is what he saw. He heard blow-by-blow description of what's going on underneath the mountain with the serving of the golden calf. Yet he didn't break the luchos till he came and he saw it with his own eyes. Not because he didn't believe God. He believed them 100%. But he didn't feel it. When he saw it with his own eyes, we're human beings. We are affected by what we see, what we feel, with our five senses. What we know intellectually is not as strong. I just wanted to say that's why it says in the end of last week's Seder, Vayomas Terach Becharon, Terach died, and the next sentence is Lech Lecha. Why? So people shouldn't say that Avraham Avinu left his old father and left him in Chutz Laretz and came to Eretz Yisrael. Terach is dead. That's not true. Or you can figure out very easily how old Terach was when he had Avram, how old Avram was when he had Yitzchak, and you'll find out that Terach was still alive then. So So what's it called? Tzarach really didn't die. And it doesn't only help for people who can add and subtract. If you can add, then it's, why did the Torah go out of its way to write Vayomas Terah Becharon and yet tell us an information to figure it out intellectually that he didn't die? The answer is because when you see it in front of you, that's what makes the bigger impression. Now you'll go and make a calculation, Terah was still alive, it's not going to make the same impression on you that he left his old father. Another case where you see that. God killed the Jews who had to die before they left Egypt in the days of darkness. Why? That Paro shouldn't see Jews dying and say, you see, it's not just me, it's them too. So therefore he did it under the cover of darkness, and that way Paro didn't see Jews dying. That's very nice if like 10 Jews would have died and nobody would ever know. 4/5 of the Jewish people died. Before the lights went out, there were 3 million Jews, 20 to 60. Now there's only 600,000 left. And the cemeteries are full. You don't have to be too smart to figure out what happened. So what did God gain by killing them during the darkness? The answer is a very big difference between seeing Jews die and calculating that they died. Very big difference. It doesn't make the same impression. Jews who saw what happened in the concentration camps made much more of an impression than people afterwards who heard about it, who deduced it, or whatever it would be. So therefore, emuna is not just believing, but it's believing so much that it's real to you. What difference does it make? Difference is, if it's really real to you, then you're willing to sacrifice for it. If it's just intellectual, then maybe you're not, it's not so real to you, maybe you're not willing to sacrifice for it. So belief also means that you are faithful to what you believe. You don't vacillate. If you really believe it, it's really real to you, then you're faithful to it. And you wouldn't think of going against that and not being consistent. You're consistent with what's real to you. So therefore the mitzvah is, the mitzvah is to people who believe already. True, the beginning of belief is like the leap of faith you have to take. But once you believe, there's a mitzvah now to make that belief real. And that comes from a lot of work. It's come from a lifetime. That's why the mitzvah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, is Asher Otzeisicha Meretz Yisrael. You have to believe as much as if you were there in Egypt and saw what happened. You'd believe a lot stronger if you saw those things. That's how strong your belief has to be. So that's what it says. Vayamin Vashem. Not just that Avram said, yeah, I believe. That would have been the case, the Ramban is right. But he believed it so much as if it was real to him. And that's a really tremendous thing. He didn't just say, yeah, God, I believe you, I'm going to have kids. He believed it as if he had the children in front of him. Which will end with a story, Chassidish story. There was a man who came to a Rebbe, didn't have children. And he begged the Rebbe for a bracha to have children. And the Rebbe told him, I'll give you my bracha. In 9 months, you can have a child. The man went home, right? Told his wife. The Rebbe said, we're going to have children. Went out and bought a baby carriage, bought a crib, whatever. Ready, made all the preparations for a child. And sure enough, 9 months later, they had a child. The shamus of this Rebbe, when he heard this story, that the man was taka blessed with a child, he said, you know, I don't have children either, and I've asked you for a bracha hundreds of times, right? And how come your bracha didn't work for me and it worked for this stranger? He said, did you ever buy a baby carriage? Right? It depends how much you believe. Somebody came to me, saw a Salanter, and he said, I just bought a lottery ticket and I'm going to win, right, 100,000, whatever it was then, right, 1 million, whatever, goulders or whatever. So, he said, I know that if you really believe and you have complete trust in the Rabban Shalom, then it's going to happen. So I really believe I'm going to win. So Rishon Shalom says, it's interesting. Right? If you really believe you're going to win, I want to be part of that. I'll give you $750,000 for that ticket now. I thought for a second. He said, okay. He said, then you don't really believe. If you really believe you're going to make $1 million on that ticket, why in the world would you sell it to me for $750,000? Must be that there's a little place where maybe you're not sure, so why not take, you know, the bird in the hand rather than the two in the bush? Then you're not going to win. I'm not interested in buying it either now. Right? But that's the difference between believing and really believing, really feeling it. That's what it says. Vayamin Bashem. Right? Avram Avinu believed to the point where it was real to him. It was like he had the children already. Then God considered that a tremendous merit for him. That's the idea.